The last time that I spoke, we were in chapter 16, and this is where David had chosen to flee Jerusalem for fear of his son Absalom. You'll probably remember Absalom. This is the guy. He's the epitome of pride. And Absalom had persuaded many of the tribes of Israel to come over and support him. And what he wanted was the crown. He wanted his father's crown. And from there, we went in and studied Psalm 3 and 5 about deliverance, that David wrote those psalms as he was fleeing from Absalom. Then Rod taught the class on chapter 17, where David's friend Hushai would give advice to Absalom as to how to defeat and destroy David and his men who were fleeing, but it was bad advice, and it was given that way on purpose. And this advice was contrary to what Absalom's trusted advisor, Ahithophel, gave. And quite honestly, that's what saved David as they were escaping the city and moving further away. Then 2 weeks ago, Gary taught the lesson over chapter 18, where the battle would take place between David's army, what was left of David's army, and Absalom's army, which was a much larger force. And we discovered through that study that David's men would actually rout the forces of Absalom and kill over 20,000 of his soldiers. It was a shocking defeat. But you know, it was a shocking defeat because only God could have orchestrated that. They didn't have the military might to defeat Absalom's army, and yet they did. And Absalom himself in that battle, if you'll remember, he was caught in a great oak tree. It never says he was caught by his hair, but it just says his head. And so some have speculated that those big locks of hair got caught in a limb and pulled him off of his donkey as he was fleeing. But in the midst of that, he's hanging there between heaven and earth. And some soldiers see him, but they don't touch him. Why? Because they heard David say to his generals, deal kindly with Absalom. Please deal kindly with Absalom. And we know that Joab, who was David's general, he put three spears right through Joab's heart. And then his armor bearers killed him. If you'll remember, that took place after David had given that warning to Joab, Abishai, his brother, and Ittai, his other general. And they just Joab deliberately disobeyed it. We'll find out that Joab is somewhat of a cold and ruthless man who deals with the military situation well, but personal interactions are not his strong suit. The title of my last three lessons, A House Divided, it's truly come to pass. David's house is just in a huge, huge mess. David's house is fulfilling God's curse. It says in 2 Samuel 12:10, now therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. You know, this whole tragedy started back when David's son Amnon raped David's daughter Tamar. And David does not discipline Amnon. He mourned for him, the situation. He was sad that it took place, but he took no action. And Absalom, the other brother, watches his father mourn for the iniquity that was done, but he also notices that his father chooses not to discipline or punish Amnon for his actions. So what does Absalom do? He waits 2 years. He gives David 2 years of time to make some type of disciplinary action with Amnon, and he doesn't. And then Absalom has Amnon killed at the hands of his servants as revenge for the rape of his sister. And David mourns Amnon's death, doesn't he? He mourns it deeply, but once again, he provides no discipline to Absalom. This man had killed another man, and he provided no discipline for him. And at that point, Absalom wasn't sure what was going to happen, so he flees Jerusalem, and he goes to live with his grandfather. And today, we're going to see again David mourning as he discovers that his son Absalom has been killed in battle. So if you're not already there, turn to 2 Samuel 19, and we're going to start with the tears of David. The scene is really set here by the final verses of chapter 18. So let's slip back to chapter 18, and we're going to read verses 31 and through 33. It says, "Behold, the Cushite arrived, and the Cushite said, 'Let my lord the king receive good news, for the Lord has freed you this day from the hand of all those who rose up against you.' Then the king said to the Cushite, 'Is it well with the young man Absalom?' And the Cushite answered, 'Let the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be as that young man.' The king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate, and he wept. And thus he said as he walked, 'Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you, O Absalom, my son, my son.'" This all takes place in David's makeshift headquarters that's located at Mahanaim up here. David had fled from Jerusalem and had taken this route, and he's up here far enough away from Jerusalem to not be easily caught. And so that's where our chapter starts. Now, the battle that took place where Absalom dies is believed to be up here in this area, in a forest area. And so the men, the Cushite, ran back sort of like a runner to tell the news. And he tells David the news. He tells him there's a great victory, but when he asks about Absalom, he finds out that he has been killed in battle. Now, at this point, David does not know how he was killed. All we know at this point is that he's been notified that his son is dead. And so that's what brings about David's anguish. And now we're in 2 Samuel 19. "Then it was told Joab, 'Behold, the king is weeping and mourns for Absalom. The victory that day was turned to mourning for all the people, for the people heard it said that day, the king is grieved for his son.' So the people went by stealth into the city that day, as people who are humiliated steal away when they flee in battle. The king covered his face and cried out with a loud voice, 'O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son.'" Let's stop there. Folks, as the chapter opens, we read of Joab. He might have been at the back of the army that was coming back into the city, and he hadn't heard about it, but he receives word that David is mourning deeply for his son. Normally, what took place in these days is a victorious army would enter the city with great fanfare. Women dancing to loud music. We even learned that they would sing songs to commemorate the event. You'll remember in 1 Samuel 18, 6 and 7 reads, "It happened as they were coming when David returned from killing the Philistine that the women came out of the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. The women sang as they played, and they said, 'Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s." Folks, there was to be a celebration for the people when your army was victorious. But what we see here is that when the soldiers hear David's wailing and mourning, that the men stop their celebrating and they quietly enter into the city as if they had stolen something and were trying to get in quietly. Although they were victorious, it was as if they were suffering the agony of defeat. Do you remember this? You remember the wide world of sports? How many of you can actually remember seeing it on television? Okay, that'll separate the young from the old. This was in 1978, and the announcer, anybody remember the announcer? His name was Jim McKay. And there was music to it. I could not get the music to play. I apologize for that. But basically what they said was the thrill of victory and that what? Agony of defeat. Well, unfortunately here in David's case, it's not the agony of defeat. It's the agony of victory. The whole city, which should have been joyous, is humiliated. And it's in a very somber mood. The king was deeply disturbed about the turn of events and is not afraid to let his emotions be shown. Folks, there are cultures and there are those in our culture that would say for a man to cry is to show great weakness. But David here weeps loudly for his loss. You know, even our Lord Jesus wept, and he wept over someone's loss. He wept over Lazarus's death. You know, there's a certain authenticity and kind of genuineness in seeing a man cry for a lost loved one. Folks, there's no weakness in that. I would rather see that than to see a man so full of pride and so hard-hearted that he couldn't show any emotions. I remember when Rocky's wife, Sue, died a few years back. I cried openly on his shoulder. It was such a sad time, and he hugged me so deeply. I had to dry clean his suit afterwards. But maybe some of you have lost loved ones, and you perfectly understand the sadness that comes with the loss of a loved one. And David has every right. He has every right to mourn over his loss of his son. David's loss was personal. But David also knew, remember, he's the king. He also knew that in every battle there's loss of life. And there were probably women and mothers in the city with him who had lost soldiers in that battle. The action of crying, the mourning that David did, it was not wrong, but the timing of it was just not appropriate. David was most likely informed of Absalom's death, commentators believe, as much as 2 to 3 days ahead before this particular incident takes place, before his army returns. And so he had the time to mourn in public, in private. But when the soldiers reached the walls of the city, he's still loudly bemoaning the loss of Absalom. And this is what provokes Joab's anger. 2 Samuel 19:5. "Then Joab came into the house of the king and said, 'Today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines by loving those who hate you and by hating those who love you. For you have shown today that princes and servants are nothing to you. For I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased. Now therefore arise, go out and speak kindly to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, surely not a man will pass the night with you. And this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now. We know all about this guy Joab, don't we? He's been with David for many, many, many years, and he's been David's general who's led his army. And if David was kind of a soft at heart type of guy, which he appears to be, then Joab was the exact opposite. Joab will, on two different occasions, take justice into his own hands and murder men as an act of revenge. One of them he's already done when he murdered Abner. Abner killed Joab's brother, and many commentators believe he killed him accidentally, but he did kill him. And so Joab kills Abner in a very deceitful way. And there will be another time in chapters to come where he'll do it again. He takes revenge into his own hands. He understood, Joab understood the rigors and dangers of war, and he'd seen many men die defending their king. He also saw many of David's men die during that battle with Absalom's forces. So at this point, Joab has no sympathy whatsoever for David's outburst of despair in front of these soldiers and his servants. They had risked their lives to protect him, to protect his family, and protect all those others that were with him. You know, folks, there are times when a person needs to be rousted from their despair. God did that to Moses. In fact, he did it twice. One was when Moses was lamenting how terrible a job he had. It says in Numbers 11, 13 through 15, it says, this is Moses speaking, "Where am I to get meat to give to all these people? For they weep before me, saying, 'Give us meat that we may eat.' I alone am not able to carry all these people because it's too burdensome for me. So if you're going to deal thus with me, please kill me at once. If I have found favor in your sight, and do not let me see my wretchedness." See, he's just moaning and complaining to God, and God intervenes at that point and provides meat for the people. He also kind of chastises Moses as he does it. There's another time that Moses would get disciplined here. In Deuteronomy 3, 25 and 27, this is where Moses wants to go into the promised land. And he said, "Let me, I pray, cross over and see the fair land that is beyond the Jordan, that good hill country and Lebanon. But the Lord was angry with me on your account and would not listen to me. And the Lord said to me, 'Enough, speak to me no more of this matter.'" See, the Lord's not afraid to discipline his people. He does it to Elijah. Remember the story of Elijah? Elijah said, "I'm the last prophet here." 1 Kings 19:14 said, then he said, talking about Elijah, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left. And they seek my life to take it away." And then we see in Kings 19:18 that God says, "Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." See, the Lord knew what was going on, and Elijah didn't. So the Lord had to basically just kind of shut him up. Folks, David needed at this point to redirect his perspective. And so Joab is just the guy to make that happen. And I would encourage you, you need someone in your life that is willing to speak to you truth, even in the hard times. Charles Haddon Spurgeon wrote, "A sensible friend who will unsparingly criticize you from week to week will be a far greater blessing to you than 1,000 undiscriminating admirers." David needed this. And Joab doesn't just chew him out here, which he does, but he provides a path for David to go down. He said, "David, get out there and speak kindly to your men." And for all of David's faults, he is not too proud to accept criticism. And he sees that what Joab is telling him is not only right for the unity of the army, but it's also politically right. If he doesn't encourage and show appreciation for his men, then he will have no one to support him. I don't know about you, but, you know, sometimes, quite honestly, I see myself in David. I get so caught up at times with the loose ends of business, the busyness of life, you know, just the rigors of everyday life that goes on, that I fail to see some of the more subtle aspects of relationships. I wish I could go around and shake hands with each and every one of you and have a 5-minute conversation. There's close to 100 people in here. We just don't have the time to do that anymore. Our church is large, and so you end up being in a smaller group to have some fellowship of more meaningfulness. But I would assume that some of you as well, you just get caught up in the busyness of life and you let things go. The old joke here, I think, applies. It's the joke that says, when you're up to your waistline and alligators, it's kind of hard to remember your job is to drain the swamp. You know what I mean? So everything's biting at you, and you forget what's really important. That's what happened to David here. David has lost sight that he should be out cheering on his army rather than lamenting in their presence. And by the way, the one that he's lamenting for, if he had had a chance, he would have taken David's life and the lives of all the people with him. So now that Absalom's revolt has been put down, the fact still remains that David and his family and his army are living in a distant location. Remember, they're not back in Jerusalem. They are up in Manhattan. Now that the threat is gone, it's time to move back to Jerusalem. But therein lies the problem as we read about the trials of David. As we move into this next section, you're going to see politics take place. Politics and all of its ugliness. You know, folks, I'm going to confess to you here. That is one subject that I will not carry on a conversation with anybody with. I don't want to talk politics. My father wanted to talk about it all the time. I would not talk about it with him. I realize there's a need for government and laws. I don't have a problem with that. And I appreciate we have those who are willing to serve. But I don't simply choose to discuss that subject. There's just so many emotions that go with it. And then the national politics these days is just so ugly that it's quite disturbing. And I'm convinced that it's only God's restraining hand that keeps our nation from being in complete anarchy. And I think his patience is wearing thin. Unfortunately, from what I see today, I think my father was right when he told me one day. I was a very young man at the time. And he said that if you weren't a crook before you entered politics, you'll be one before you get out. And, you know, it's so sad to see so many people turn that way. But right here in our passage, what we're going to see is David acting upon Joab's advice to go out to the men. And he's going to begin to get back into the leadership of the nation. He's going to begin to take back over his role of king and act as he should be acting. And the first thing that we'll see is the resolution. Verse 8. So the king arose and sat in the gate. When they told all the people, saying, "Behold, the king is sitting in the gate," then all the people came before the king. Now Israel had fled, each to his tent. So the king is sitting in the gate. This is the Jaffa Gate. And you can see to the right there, the Citadel of David. For those of you that are going to Israel this year, you will see this. I walked in and out of the Jaffa Gate many, many times. They're named by which town they were in the direction of going to. And so this is part of the old city of Jerusalem. And so David was sitting in the gate area, and the people loyal to him are gathered around him. And although there's no recording of it, David undoubtedly went there at Joab's insistence to praise his army and to tell him thank you and to give thanks to those who had remained loyal to him in a very difficult time. So the people who had stayed with David the entire time, they're glad to see the king at the gate, and so they come and gather around him. But also among that crowd, there's other parts of the kingdom, other parts of the tribes, the splintered tribes, and these were people that had sided with Absalom. So we have David's loyal people there, but we also have people who had sided with Absalom showing up at the gate. And so at this point, our author, the writer of this book, focuses on the discussion that is taking place among these people, these other tribes. And they had gathered to hear and see David. And so there was many locations that came to see him at the gate. And they began to discuss David as their king and whether they should accept him back as their king. And think of a political debate here these people are having, and a discussion of who should they nominate to be king or president kind of thing. And that's where you see it moves into the argument. Verses 9 and 10 read, "All the people were quarreling throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, 'The king delivered us from the land of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines. But now he has fled out of the land from Absalom. However, Absalom, whom we appointed over us, has died in battle. Now then, why are you silent about bringing the king back?'" See, these conversations start out nice, and then they turn into arguments, which is typically what happens in politics. And they all agree that as many times in the past, David's delivered them. He's been the one who's kept them from being overrun by the Philistines and others. But then they also notice how quickly he fled from his son Absalom. And so they're beginning to question, is he worthy to be our king? Will he lead us fearlessly in face of great obstacles again? Can he be counted on to not run again? And I think, honestly, this is where his age is beginning to become a factor. As they argue among themselves if he's the right man for the job. You know, in his younger days, David was not someone to be trifled with. But now he's beginning to show cracks in that courageous exterior of his character. And so they're beginning to question, is this the right guy? So the arguments go on, and as the incessant debating continues, in the background, David kind of slyly, in verse 11, sends word to Zadok and Abiathar. And that's where we read of the appeal. Let's read verses 11 and 12. Then King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, saying, "Speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house? Since the word of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house, you are my brothers. You are my bone and my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring the king back?" So David sends words to two priests. And remember these, when he fled, these were two priests that wanted to flee with him. And he said, "No, I'll need you to go back. I need you to be there in Jerusalem, sort of as like my spies." And so he sends word to these two priests who were in Jerusalem. And he wants them to convince the elders of the tribe of Judah. By the way, much of the tribe of Judah had betrayed David and had gone with Absalom. So he wants them to convince the elders to bring David back into the city. "You are my own tribe. You are my own flesh and blood. Shouldn't you be the very first to stand up and say, bring him back?" That's what he is desiring here. David appeals to his own tribal leadership for reconciliation. David's in kind of full-fledged kingdom restoration mode. He's trying to begin to restore the kingdom to unity. And I'm convinced, folks, that this idea, this method that he used was rather from God and not from David. This is where God gave David the wisdom to concoct this plan, and it's about to bring about much needed unity to the kingdom after it's been so splintered. David is about to show the tribe of Judah mercy. It's going to be forgiveness, leniency, compassion. In our modern vernacular, a presidential pardon. As commentator William Blakey put it, an act of wonderful clemency. It was such a contrast to the usual treatment of rebels. But this king was not like other kings. He gave gifts even to the rebellious. Where sin abounded, grace did much more abound. So David forgives them and wants them to be a single unit again. And he set in place a plan to win the hearts of those who had once opposed him and gone with Absalom. And he's going to up the ante one more time here when we see the appointment. Verses 13, 14, and 15 read this. "Say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? May God do so to me and more also if you will not be commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab." Then he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah as one man, so that they sent word to the king saying, "Return, you and all your servants." And the king returned and came as far as the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal in order to go to meet the king, to bring the king across the Jordan. David even forgives the man who was the general of the forces of the army that he was just fighting against. And you know, David considered the heartlessness of Joab to be appalling. And he would rather have Amasa leading his army than Joab. Amasa was a nephew of David's, and was of the same tribe, just like Joab was. But Joab had deliberately disobeyed David's instructions, and by this time it's probably pretty certain that David knew about that, his instructions to deal kindly with Absalom. As a punishment to Joab, he appoints Amasa to take his place. And so this was a dangerous move because this involved favoritism, outward favoritism toward his own tribe and against Joab. But David was also very aware that Absalom's uprising was a punishment to him from God, and therefore mercy and forgiveness was in order. David knew that since he had been forgiven for his sins and had been allowed to live, you remember Nathan saying that, "You will not die," that he should show the same type of mercy to others. So what's the result of David's forgiveness? We find out that when we read the agreement. "Thus he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah." You know, the plan worked. And Judah calls for the king to return to Jerusalem. So he and all his family, his servants, his followers, they start the trek home to Jerusalem. And when they get as far as Gilgal, you see it here on the map, the tribe of Judah comes out to meet him, to welcome him home, to bring him back across the Jordan. And this is where we read of the return. David's return to his palace and to his headquarters city has truly begun in earnest. And as they reach the Jordan River, David is met by several interesting characters. I'm only going to cover one of them this week. The others will be covered next week. The first one that David encounters here is Shimei. Do you remember Shimei? How many of you remember Shimei? He's this guy. He's the guy that when David was leaving Jerusalem, headed away, fleeing, this was a guy that was throwing stones at him and cursing him. He is that guy. And so he shows up to meet David at Gilgal. You remember what David's mighty man Abishai wanted to do to Shimei? David had to restrain him. He said, "I'm going to cut that dead dog's head off for cursing the king." But David would not allow it. Why would David not allow it? Why the mercy then for Shimei? It says in 2 Samuel 16:11-12 this, "Then David said to Abishai and to all of his servants, 'Behold, my son who came out from me seeks my life.'" He's talking about Absalom. "How much more now this Benjamite?" He's talking about Shimei. "Let him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him. Perhaps the Lord will look on my affliction and return good to me instead of cursing this day." David forgave him, Shimei, at that point. He did not do anything with him. David knew he deserved the embarrassment that was happening as he left the city, and he allowed it to continue. But now when David encounters Shimei again, we read of Shimei's fear. Verse 16, "Then Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, who is from Bahurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, with Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him. And they rushed to the Jordan before the king. Then they kept crossing the ford to bring over the king's household to do what was good in his sight. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan. So he said to the king, 'Let not my lord consider me guilty, nor remember what your servant did wrong on the day when my lord the king came out from Jerusalem, so that the king would take it to heart. For your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come today, the first of all of the house of Joseph, to go down to meet my lord, the king.'" Folks, as David crosses over the Jordan, he encounters Shimei the Benjamite and over 1,000 other Benjamites. And they came down to offer their apologies and to welcome David back. And Shimei speaks first. And where just a few weeks before, Shimei was the one who was so brave as to throw stones at the king and to curse him, he realizes now that Absalom is gone, the rebellion is gone, it is over. And David's still in charge. And he himself, Shimei realizes, he himself is toast. And so he goes and he falls at David's feet and he begs for mercy. He begs David not to hold him guilty. He begs David not to even remember what happened to him. And he confesses his sin profusely before David. So what does David do? Well, that's where we read of David's forgiveness. Verses 21 to 23. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said, "Should not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed?" David then said, "What have I to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah, that you should this day be an adversary to me? Should any man be put to death in Israel today? For do I not know that I am king over Israel today?" The king said to Shimei, "You shall not die." Those words had to mean something to David because he heard them from the prophet Nathan when David deserved to die. It says, "Thus the king swore to him." Who steps up to offer his suggestion of what should happen to Shimei? Good old Abishai. You remember Abishai? He's the guy who solves all his problems with a sword. And so we should not be surprised that he believes Shimei should be executed right there on the spot. And when you think of him and his two brothers, Joab and Asahel, the sons of Zeruiah, I think of the term bash brothers. That's how they dealt with all of their problems. They dealt with violence, and especially Joab. So Abishai says, "I vote we kill him. What's your vote?" David says, "No man shall be put to death today." And so he forgives Shimei there. And he swears to him that he shall not die. What a heart of forgiveness. Folks, do you know who are the most forgiving people in the world? They're the people who realize how much they've been forgiven. When you realize the forgiveness that's been extended to you, then you become a more forgiving person. You know, on a cross, 1,000 years after David's sin, a man who had no sin gave up his life that you and I might be forgiven. He who was shown no mercy, showed mercy to his own crucifiers, and he has shown great mercy to you and I who were once his enemies. David that day showed mercy in a situation where the ordinary man or woman would have exacted vengeance. David knew he had been forgiven for much, and he showed Shimei mercy as well. Folks, as we end this lesson, I want you to not forget and not miss the overarching scenario that is unfolding here. David was being punished by God, who had told David that because of his sin with Bathsheba, the sword would never depart from his house. And David knows that. This whole tragic saga of outpouring of consequences for David's sin, it begins years before when David would choose to not discipline his children. It's not why God chose to punish David, but it's the instrument that God uses to discipline David. God uses David's missed parental opportunities to discipline himself and his family. David's sin with Bathsheba and his murder of Uriah was the turning point in God's discipline of David. But God uses David's years of lack of discipline of his own children as the instrument to begin and to continue to just wreak havoc on his house. So, what is the application for our lives? Folks, we need to realize, just like I don't think David realized, that as parents, we have a great responsibility to raise our children up in the admonition of the Lord. And that involves teaching, that involves correction, reproof, and discipline. And you know, sadly in our day today, there are so many that have chosen David's path of being sorrowful for the actions of their children, but failing to act as a disciplinarian for them. And often like father, like son. In 1974, a man named Harry Chapin wrote and performed a song. Turned out to be his only number one hit. It was called Cats in the Cradle. It's about a boy who wanted to grow up to be just like his dad. Let me read you the lyrics to it. It says, "My child arrived just the other day. He came into the world in the usual way. But there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away. And he was talking, for I knew it. And as he grew, he said, I want to be just like you. I'm going to be just like you." And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man in the moon. "When you coming home, Dad?" "I don't know when, but we'll get together then. You know, we'll have a good time then. But my son turned 10 just the other day. He said, thanks for the ball, Dad. Come on, let's play. Can you teach me to throw? I said, not today. I got a lot to do." And he said, "That's okay." And he walked away, but his smile never dimmed. It said, "I'm going to be like him. Yeah, you know I'm going to be like him." Well, he came from college just the other day. "So much like a man, I just had to say, son, I'm proud of you. Can you sit for a while?" He shook his head and he said with a smile, "What I'd really like, Dad, is to borrow the car keys. See you later. Can I have them, please?" And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon, the little boy blue and the man in the moon. "When you coming home, Dad?" "I don't know when, but we'll get together then. You know we'll have a good time then." "I've long since retired and my son's moved away. I called him up just the other day. I said, I'd like to see you if you don't mind. He said, I'd love to, Dad, if I could find the time. You see, my new job's a hassle and the kids have the flu. But it's sure nice talking to you, Dad. It's been sure nice talking to you." And as I hung up the phone, it occurred to me, he'd grown up just like me. My boy was just like me. And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man in the moon. "When you coming home, son?" "I don't know when, but we'll get together then, Dad. We're going to have a good time then." Okay, folks, if you haven't figured it out, my belief is that David's actions as a parent spoke much louder than his words. How about you? How about me? You know, we have a limited amount of time to train up our children, and the last thing we want to have after they're gone is deep regrets. So that begs the question of, do we want our children to grow up just like us? Well, I listened to a song quite a bit this week as I've been studying, and it was a song of a challenge, but also an encouragement for you. And so I want to play this song for you that I think will be something you'll enjoy. so. Let me get it set up. Didn't know I was going to have to undress for this. All right.
He climbs in my lap for a good night hug. He calls me dead and I call him Bob. With his faded old pillow, bare name Pooh, he snuggles up close and says, I wanna be like you. I tuck him in bed and I kiss him goodnight, tripping over the toys as I turn out the light. I whisper a prayer that someday he'll got a father and God, 'cause he's seen Jesus in me. Lord, I wanna be just like you, 'cause he wants to be just like me. Wanna be a holy example for his innocent eyes to see. Help me be a living Bible, Lord, that my little boy can be.
So what is the application to our lives today? Well, it's what I believe David would have desired as he looked back on his life. And that application is that he would live a godly life that his children would want to emulate. Folks, I pray the same thing for myself, and I pray that for you, that your life would be focused on Jesus Christ in a way that your life expressed a living Bible that your children could read. Let's pray. Father, you are so good to us, and we so often forget the forgiveness that you give us each and every day, the mercy that you give us every new morning. Lord, thank you for this story. Thank you that it touches our hearts, knowing how sad David was, and yet being a good lesson for us to read. Father, lead us, guide us, and direct us. For those of us who still have young children, I pray that you will give them the wisdom to lead their children in a way that honors and pleases you. As we go into the service now, may you just lift our hearts of joy, knowing that you are our King, and you sit on the throne today, and you love us deeply. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.